Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
Lord help me.
This mother lashes out.
You executed my daughter.
As jurors send this convicted killer to the execution chamber.
Your life, Mr. Executioner, will end peacefully.
Plus, this father can't stand to look at autopsy photos of the child authorities say he neglected until the child died. And an on-duty officer gunned down his accused killer on trial. That's straight ahead on the Daily Debrief for Thursday, November 1st.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief on the third day of testimony in a case against an Iowa man said by prosecutors to have murdered his own four-month-old child. Authorities testified that they found the body of Sterling Keene rotted and infested with maggots. A medical examiner said the child died from neglect. 28-year-old Zachary Keene faces murder and child neglect charges. The victim's mother faces a separate trial on those same charges. Keene appeared upset in court as prosecutors played a 911 call where he said his girlfriend checked on the child and found him dead. During that call, Keene theorized that maybe the child died of sudden infant death syndrome. Later, he told investigators a slightly different story. This time, he said he arrived home from work, fell asleep, and that his girlfriend later woke him up and told him Sterling was dead. Keene said he was disoriented at the time. Today, Keene covered his face, refused to look, as the prosecutor showed the jury graphic photos of his son's autopsy. But there are many faces to Zachary Keene. At one point, our cameras caught him sharing in a joke with someone in the courtroom while sitting there on trial for his son's alleged murder. The state medical examiner today testified that Sterling Keene died from a denial of critical care. Here is what that means.
Denial of critical care means what was it that actually caused Sterling's death? If we get down to the basic, what really started all the events that eventually led to his death? And if you look at a young child who's dependent on an adult or someone who's responsible for that child for food, clothing, shelter, and all the care that's necessary for that child's health, well-being, and life, there were some of those critical things that were not provided to Sterling that started a series of different derangements that I was able to identify in autopsy that caused his death.
That pretty much sums up what the state needs to prove legally to get a conviction in this case. But from there, the medical examiner testified about the downward spiral from discomfort to illness to death that this baby suffered.
The malnutrition, as far as hunger is one of those major survival drives in humans. And so the hunger is going to be a feeling of discomfort to a child, and they're going to respond by crying. And there's going to be this feeling that they may or may not understand. Dehydration is going to vary. There's still a thirst drive that people are going to have. That's one of the more powerful drives for survival, is to make sure that you have enough fluid. So there would be some stimuli. How that child understood that, I don't know. And then there is the infection component, which when we have a fever, that's a generally uncomfortable feeling. It's just they're going to respond to that by being cranky and irritable. And then finally, there's the actual physical painful component of the diaper rash. It's tender. It's going to be very painful for touching that area. As you start becoming more infected and you become more dehydrated, your ability to actually respond and have what your awareness of these various stimuli, I think, would probably decline over time.
It was a horrible end for that child. Today's testimony followed a parade of first responders called by prosecutors to describe the scene.
Say I do.
I do.
The prosecution called witness after witness to testify about arriving at the Keene home and finding little Sterling dead.
His eyes were open and he was a blank stare.
Nurse Tony Friedrich was there early.
His arm was cold and stiff, and he had what appeared to be blood around his, on the side of his mouth. My assessment is this is not a baby who I can do CPR on.
You raise your right hand.
Chief Deputy Reed Paulo struggled to make sense of it.
You can see every rib. Really small.
His assessment continued.
There was feces and urine that had been straining through the diaper for a long time.
Deputy Jason Rosel said air fresheners had been deployed to cover up this.
The first thing that I could smell was human urine. When I got closer to baby, I could smell, I guess the only way to describe it is death.
Medical investigator Jeremy McGrath said the little boy was covered in blankets that became wet with decomposition.
Was there anything else unusual that you saw around the child?
I noticed flies and gnats.
Prosecutors estimate that Sterling Keene was left for between 9 and 14 days before his parents finally called for help.
Malnutrition, dehydration, infection caused by diaper rash. That's what caused this child's death. And ladies and gentlemen, the evidence will show that this defendant, the father of that child, is responsible for that death.
At the beginning of this case, the defense cautioned jurors not to rush to judgment. Then the defense said this was a tragedy, but not a crime.
This case is about the death of a child. Nothing anybody says throughout this trial is going to soften that. It's a terrible thing. The problem is, of course, that a tragedy like this creates a gut reaction in us. We want to punish them. There's an automatic tendency to what we refer to as rush to judgment. As jurors, it is your responsibility, it is your job not to do that. This is a tragedy, but not a crime. We're going to ask you to return a verdict of not guilty.
One critical witness for the defense thus far was a social services worker who testified about the child's mother's drug use. Apparently, the hospital caught it but never reported it. The witness appeared to dodge that reality on cross-examination.
Based on your position as a child protective worker, what does the presence of methamphetamine in a baby's umbilical cord mean?
It means that the mother used methamphetamine during her pregnancy.
If an infant is born with an illegal substance such as methamphetamine in their body, that's grounds for DHS intervention, isn't it?
It is if it's reported to the hotline, yes.
Were you able to determine whether or not there had actually been a referral to a social worker for this family?
Can you clarify when you say social worker, are you referring to an agency, a hospital? I need you to repeat the question.
Were you able to determine during your investigation whether there had ever actually been a referral made?
A referral made to where? I guess I'm confused by your question.
To a social worker. Was the report that this family would be referred for social work ever followed up on to your knowledge?
Specifically, no.
The issue of the defendant and his partner's use of drugs came up another time with this testimony from a friend.
During all those times that you saw the defendant, did he ever tell you that he had a baby?
Not that I can recall.
He didn't tell you that he had a baby son?
No.
Did you know he had a little girl?
Yes.
Did he talk about the little girl?
Yes.
How often would he talk about his little girl?
At least once a night or every time I seen him.
But never about the baby?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a no?
No.
Did you ever see the defendant use drugs?
Yes.
What drugs did he use that you saw him use?
Meth and cocaine were the main two. couple of rare occasions was marijuana.
How often would he use the methamphetamine?
Daily.
Juvenile Court Judge Ashley Wilcott is our analyst tonight on the Daily Debrief. Let's start, Ashley, with this issue of the drug use. I'm sorry, for some reason I can't say your name
That's
tonight.
All right.
Anyway,
it's all good.
We've done this many times. So look, the defense seems to be setting itself up to blame the mother for the drug use and for the authorities for not catching it through a chain of apparently what are supposed to be mandatory reports or something. What's your assessment?
We need to take the drug use out of it, failure to report by a hospital out of it, because a father in a home with a child still has a responsibility, Aaron, to care for that child. And just because those other things existed doesn't remove the accountability, culpability of this child dying while he was in the home caring for the child with the mother.
You know, late today, the father got on the stand and tried to say, well, this particular defendant's upbringing led him to believe that it was the mother's job to really take care of this. So there's deflection, there's blaming other people. Is this going to work?
I don't think it is. I almost think it's going to backfire, because basically they said only an eighth grade education, implying that those who don't have formal education may abuse or neglect their children. Not the case. Or because of religious reasons. It doesn't mean someone with religious reasons is going to abuse or neglect their child. I think it's going to backfire.
Iowa's first-degree murder law has a specific subsection just for child neglect situations that result in death, but the state has to prove extreme indifference to human life. Can the father get out of this by saying, I was stoned out of my mind half the time?
No, I don't think so at all, because there's still an extreme indifference to human life, leaving this child in a swing for 9 to 14 days and letting the child basically rot to death, regardless of if you're using drugs or not, is intentional.
We will be back to your analysis in a moment, Ashley, on another case. Still ahead, though, tonight on the Daily Debrief, 2 death penalty cases remain on our docket. In Texas, a mother's harsh words for her daughter's killer. Also, Tennessee police officer gunned down in the line of duty. A defendant there fighting for his own life. That's when we return on the Daily Debrief.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back, everybody. Now for other incidents beside trials making headlines, here is Anthony Velez.
Here are today's top crime stories trending on longcrime.com and across the country. The caregiver of missing 4-year-old Darnell Gray, who disappeared from his Jefferson City home and was found dead earlier this week, reportedly confessed to the killing. 26-year-old Quatavia Gibbons allegedly told investigators she hurt Darnell, stating she may have hit him wrong. Darnell disappeared from his home on Buena Vista Street, and Gibbons initially reported Darnell missing before his body was discovered after Gibbons told authorities its location. Gibbons now faces a charge of neglect or abuse of a child resulting in death. A former Rutgers University football player arrested after authorities uncovered his plan to murder his ex-girlfriend's family members allegedly confessed to devising the murderous plot. 22-year-old Isaiah Bullock of Piscataway, New Jersey, faces two counts of attempted first-degree murder and conspiracy for the alleged plot to kill after a friend made an audio recording of Bullock detailing his plans. Authorities searched Bullock's car and found a mask, gloves, and crushed Tylenol. Bullock was immediately dismissed from Rutgers football team, and the university has initiated disciplinary proceedings. Outraged parents are calling for the St. Louis police to file child abuse charges against two preschool teachers who were caught on camera running a preschool fight club. The two unidentified educators reportedly organized the all-day fight club at the Adventure Learning Center in Bevo Mill, pitting preschoolers against each other. A 10-year-old recorded some of the bruising miniature beatdowns and sent the video to his mother, who contacted the director of the daycare. Both teachers were fired, but prosecutors declined to prosecute the educators. Those were today's top crime stories. I'm Anthony Velez for the Daily Debrief.
We are in day two of testimony in a death penalty murder trial against Tremaine Wilborn. He is the Tennessee man accused of shooting and killing an on-duty police officer. That officer, Sean Bolton, was, as I said, on duty. Prosecutors say Wilborn pulled the trigger 8 times to avoid arrest. After the shooting, Wilborn is accused of carjacking another man at gunpoint, but he turned himself in after a massive manhunt. A police dispatcher said Bolton was taking a long time to answer a call, and then she heard a bizarre transmission over the police radio.
It was something like, hello, you have a man down. I really wasn't sure if it was the officer or who it was at that time. I didn't know if it's the officer's radio, if he went out the window, he needed help, or I didn't know what to expect.
So you talked about somebody coming on the radio. Do you know the name of that person that got on the radio?
His last name is Lanier, Mr. Lanier.
Okay. And did you know that then, or did you learn that since then?
I learned that after the fact.
364 Delta.
Y'all got a man down.
What, sir?
Okay. He said he's too old, so I'm like, hurry up, he bleeds, my bad, man.
Are these all calls that are coming in about that same time?
Yes.
So, testimony revealed that a passerby picked up the police radio to notify other officers that one of their fellow officers had been shot. Next, witnesses testified that some sort of commotion at the scene led to gunfire and then chaos.
I heard gunshots.
Do you know how many gunshots you heard?
Maybe about 5.
Okay. Do you remember whether they were all at one time or spaced apart, or do you remember that?
Not really, no.
Okay. And why? What were you worried about when you started hearing gunshots?
I was worried about my kids.
Okay. So what did you do when you started hearing gunshots?
I immediately ran back in the house to check on the kids.
Okay. Where did your boyfriend, O'Taper, did he stay outside? He go in with you?
No, he stayed outside.
Okay.
Before I left, he started calling the police.
Okay. Do you know, when you started hearing shots, could you tell where the shooter was or where the officer was? Could you see that or not?
I never seen the police. at all.
All right.
I can tell the guy was backing up.
Okay. Could you hear the shots as he was backing up?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Could you tell where he was pointing the gun or not?
Yeah, I know he was pointing the gun this direction.
Okay. Was he pointed up or down, or do you remember?
I don't remember.
Okay. But he was backing up, and you could hear shots being fired.
Yes, ma'am.
Let's move on now to Dallas, Texas, where a jury recommended that a man be sent to death row. That recommendation came late yesterday. The same jury previously convicted Christopher Love of murdering dentist Kendra Hatcher. Prosecutors said Love was a hitman hired by the ex-girlfriend of Hatcher's new boyfriend. The death recommendation was the first in Dallas County in 4 years. The victim's sister and mother lashed out during victim impact statements.
To me, for 3 years, you have only been known as the shooter. And I will never call you by your name because you are just the shooter. Until I found out you were the executioner of my daughter. You didn't shoot her. You executed my daughter for absolutely no reason in the world. Your life, I pray, someday soon will end one way or another. And if you received the ultimate, your life, Mr. Executioner, will end peacefully, unlike my daughter's, Dr. Hatcher. You chose to end her life. For what, besides drug and prostitution money? I've tried to feel something, to try to feel sorry for him, and I can't do it. I can't do it. So many nights I've laid awake in my bed and thought of my little sister and her last moments on this earth. $500 and drugs, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Do you know what she would have given you to save her life? What I would have given you? What our family would have given you? Her life was so much more than that. She had so much to offer, and we'll never get to see that. And to the jury, I can't thank you enough. I've thought of you and prayed of you every single day since they said they were selecting jurors. All of this could have been avoided with a stupid, stupid, ignorant decision that could have been stopped. It was planned. It was thought out. It could have been stopped. No one, none of us would have had to be here if he hadn't pulled that trigger.
Ashley Wilcott joins us one last time here on the Daily Debrief. Ashley, look, this family's pain was raw in that courtroom, and opinions may differ about the death penalty, but the mother made it clear she wanted this defendant dead.
Absolutely, 100%, Aaron. And so the other part of this was a crime that happened 3 years ago, and so this family's had 3 years ago to mourn, although that's not going to make it any better. Think how raw this emotion still is. They clearly, this is a senseless murder that they are not going to recover from.
You know, I think the mother put it bluntly there. This was a premeditated, planned out killing with multiple witnesses taking the stand and saying, we were caught up in this plan from this jealous ex-girlfriend of this victim's new boyfriend. And they outlined it step by step by step, what they were going to do. They trailed the victim. They described trailing the victim. They described trial runs of this killing. I've said this before and I'll say it again. I can't remember any case that we've covered here where there was as clear of a mountain of evidence of premeditation as we saw in this one.
I agree with you, and I think that's why the conviction came so quickly. But the other part of that to remember is all of those all the steps that they took to plan this murder, and it was against someone that didn't even know them. She didn't see it coming. She was clueless. It was an execution of someone, not someone that she knew that she got into trouble with.
Yeah, you know, there was evidence that the boyfriend had kept in touch with the jealous ex-girlfriend because they had a joint phone account, and all of that hadn't been unraveled yet. But, you know, did this victim know about any of this? It's just such a horrible case. Drugs and prostitution money, as the mother said.
Right, and the way that she was with the car and the pictures, and she was opening the back door to put her purse in and put her things away, she did not see this coming.
Ashley Wilcott, appreciate your insight on the Daily Debrief.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. A reminder that the Law and Crime Network will be streaming many of the trials we discussed live, beginning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. From all of us here at the Law and Crime Network and at the Daily Debrief, have a very good evening. We'll be right back.